So if we can bring up the next panel here, and what we're really trying to hone in on, of course, is that we have post-prohibition problems associated for consumers, and to certainly some degree, the industry as well. And so I'm going to introduce the panel here before bringing them up for, in the case of Jordan and Kevin, they have some individual presentations. So Jordan Pearson is the head of Denver Normal, and she is spearheading the Denver Social Initiative, the first opportunity to vote to get personal use of marijuana outside the house, very much like a coffee shop experience, except you won't be able to buy the marijuana there. Of course, in time, I would expect that's what most of us are looking forward to, but incrementally speaking, the efforts that she's putting forward is really crucial in the country. So we're really blessed to have Jordan here today to talk about what she sees in the most integrated legalization state and metroplex in the country, Denver. Kevin Oliver is on Normal's board of directors. He's the head of Washington Normal. And unlike probably anybody else in this room, he grows acres of weed legally. And produces a crop called Washington's Finest. And so he has got to see not only how it's worked for the consumers, but somebody like himself, who's jumped through many regulatory hoops to try to get to the point to legally sell marijuana. And Kevin Zeis is one of eight Normal directors over the last 46 years. Kevin began as a criminal defense lawyer, but realized not long after that he really is a social justice organizer, and he has done it in so many different capacities. Certainly drug policy reform. He was Ralph Nader's lawyer during his presidential runs. Kevin has been at the vanguard of social reform in this country, and so I'm very curious to know what his views are and his travels in places where marijuana has been legal, because when he was the director of Normal in the mid-80s, I would suggest to you was the bleakest, worst time for the prospect of reform, but it never stopped him or then later John Getman, who replaced Kevin, that they were the ones that held together the core opposition to prohibition. And so we're blessed to have all three of them here today. And I'm just quickly setting up 15 or so things. Some are obvious, some not, and a couple of esoteric regarding what are the 15 basic concerns we have about marijuana legalization. And that is the public use, that you cannot use marijuana outside your home. So this is clearly insufficient to deal with the worst aspects of prohibition and to allow consumer freedom. In almost all the states that have legalization, and then prospectively, the argument is you can have legal marijuana, but you can't advertise it. Really? You can still advertise tobacco. It only kills 400,000 people per annum. Alcohol, pharmaceuticals, all kinds of potentially dangerous services and products are advertised. And I defy you to find and tell me any other product that is legal and taxed but cannot be advertised in a country with the First Amendment. Access to banking and financial services, it's obvious. This is actually one of the reasons why descheduling or rescheduling might occur is because the bank and the financial services cannot really enjoy legalization. Consumer lobby staples. What I mean by this is labeling, testing, torts. So if you buy a product and you're harmed and you can prove sufficiently, then you can sue the company. Just like if you opened up a can of Coke or you open a bag of Doritos or whatever, you have a tort against them. And a lot of people in the industry, cannabis industry, gird against this, but hello, that's reality. That is commerce in America. And of course, we need to amend the US and UN anti-treaties, anti-drug treaties. Technically, the United States, certainly some of our states are in total conflict with the UN treaties. Same thing with many other countries. Canada is clearly about to become the country in most conflict, along with Uruguay. Amend drug testing. Here I would suggest to you, this is regrettable, that regardless of the legality of a drug, companies, if you're engaged in a social contract of working for that company, can still ask you to drug test. We have drug testing today for tobacco. Tobacco's legal and taxed. So I would suggest, while we should work very hard in that area, there could be an argument made that there's still going to be drug testing during prohibition, during legalization, because if a company wants it and you want to work for that company, unless we have a big sea change of views and culture, and allow for home cultivation and processing in reasonable amounts. This is what normal's always believed in, is you should be able to grow a small amount on your own. Amend the Controlled Substances Act, obviously, to bring it down in scheduling. We'd love to see it out of all scheduling. Alcohol and tobacco are not scheduled. I think everybody in this room would be comfortable with having marijuana placed with alcohol and tobacco outside of scheduling. And what Michael was alluding to in his remarks, Michael Kennedy, is this immorality I take home every night with me. We still have about 100,000 people in jail in the United States. There's an angelic woman named Beth, name is escaping me, who runs Life.
Curtis.
Thank you. Beth Curtis, Life for Pot. There she tracks about 14 to 15 men who are serving life in prison for non-violent marijuana offenses. And there are more than 15, I promise you. Driving under the influence of drugs, so that they'd be accurate and relevant, and Normal is certainly involved in helping state legislatures and regulators try to come up with reasonable scientific-based testing, acknowledging there's going to be standards for driving impaired, just like we have for alcohol. Even if, in fact, some people technically drive better under the influence of marijuana, there is still going to be tests for this. Civil forfeiture reforms. Clearly, these have to come out of prohibition, the idea that you can have your property taken from you with no judge or jury, for all intents and purposes, ruling against you, that the property is charged, not you. And, of course, amend state and federal legislation on what's called, euphemistically, smoke a joint, lose your license. In 22 states, if you get caught with even a joint, you lose your ability to drive. Now, in D.C., that's inconsequential. Where I grew up on Cape Cod, that's the end of your economic existence. And, of course, the idea that right now, though this is part of the maturation of the industry, the first couple of states allowed no out-of-state investors. Well, Oregon and Colorado are going to now out-of-state investors.
Washington allows it.
And Washington, too. Yes, thankfully in your case. Amend state cannabis laws that allow formally convicted persons to challenge, to be in the industry. The idea that thousands and thousands of people are banned from being in the marijuana industry simply because they got caught when it was illegal. And amend child endangerment laws. I mean, you can just be sitting in your house using cannabis legally and still have child protective services come. We've represented many men and women, people who have been in states where they have a state-issued medical card, and they still have their children taken away from them simply because they possess or the mother used marijuana. These are esoteric, I'll grant you. These are almost, I was at a meeting in France in the 1990s where we were musing about what were problems we wish we had post-prohibition. And this was it, one of them, I remember, was the idea that you would have cannabis and hemp outdoor cultivation cross-pollinating. It's happening right now in Oregon. And there's a woman named Courtney Moran, who was one of our legal interns a couple of years. She's really one of the lead people in the country trying to work through this problem, legally, culturally, botanically. How can you have outdoor production of these two plants and you absolutely do not want cross-pollination?
Sure.
Second Amendment rights, for those that don't know, even if you have a state-issued ID for medical marijuana, if the sheriff or others come to know that you have that card, and you, or say you're seeking, as we found out, someone was trying to get a carry permit,
sure, sure.
And then they found out that they were a medical marijuana patient, under federal law, you can't buy guns or ammunition. So in essence, your Second Amendment rights are mollified if you are a legal patient. And one could argue under legalization, too, unless we address this. And again, government, what could be a better example here in D.C.? The idea that, like, 3 out of 5 people that work in this area work for the federal government, but they don't enjoy any of the benefits of legalization. Even though marijuana is depenalized here, the federal workers and the contractors still are really existing in a world of prohibition. Section 8 housing, you know, going to the fact that individuals who are either older or poor in public housing are not enjoying the benefits of legalization. And lastly, cross-border travel. People like myself have a hell of a time getting across the Canadian border, whether they just find out whether you've been arrested or just Google your name. They do not have to let you into Canada if they feel that you have some past history with marijuana. You type my name into Google, you get like 5 million hits. So I'm going to open this. I'm going to ask Jordan to come up first and talk about what she is seeing in Colorado and the efforts that they're doing to really give the consumer a voice. We're going to go to Q&A at the end.
Often last with a Z last name.
That's probably what it is. She's M-M-A.
Hello, everyone. Hello. Okay. So my name is Jordan Person. I'm the executive director of Denver Normal. We started about 9 or 10 months ago, and I believe there has been a Denver Normal or a Mile High chapter or some version thereof, I think every decade since Normal started. But we have been around just for, like I said, roughly 9 or 10 months. But we have been very, very busy. We made it our goal to try and change something about the city. And the thing that we needed and that we lacked the most was the ability to consume. In Denver alone, we have just under 200 dispensaries. But the only place that you can legally consume is your private residence. So as I'm sure you've all heard on the news all the time, we made just under $1 billion last year in tax revenue. That's primarily from the tourists that are coming into our state every day to consume our legal marijuana. But these tourists come in and they receive public consumption citations anywhere from $50 to $250 with each citation because they have nowhere to go. If they smoke at their Airbnb, the Airbnb owner can throw them out. If they smoke in an apartment, in a hotel, the fines have gone from $100 to $500. Some hotels charge people if they think they smell cannabis. And they even have the consumers sign something when they come in that says, if we think we smell it, we will charge your credit card. So it's become a huge, huge issue in our city. My company, we do cannabis massage, and we go to all these different hotels and businesses and homes, and that's the first question we're asked everywhere we go. Where do we go to smoke this? Because I feel like if I smoke it here, I'm going to get arrested. So that's our issue, Responsible Use Denver. Grassroots has worked with Normal extensively. They always make the hats that you guys see out there. Those are all Grassroots hats. They donated their time and energy to our campaign because they actually had one of the first and only cannabis clubs that operated in Denver, and it was called The Break Room. And basically, it started because they have t-shirts and hats at the front of their business. They had a room at the back that was their break room, and people would stop by in between break at work and take a dab. And so it became known as The Break Room. It was an underground space, and the police found out about it, and 420 last year, they shut it down, and they made a public event of the entire thing. So when they found out that we were approaching this issue, they donated their time and energy and created a logo and created hats for us, and we have them out there in case anybody wants to support our cause. But that truly has become what Denver Normal is focused on. We are calling it Responsible Use Denver because that's what we are proving. We are responsible users. Cannabis users are not that stereotypical stoner type. We're still trying to disprove that all these years later. So, Responsible Use Denver. What does it mean and what will it do? 21 and up only. Membership model to be decided by business owner. So, there's a few different ways that this can be done. We have a place in Inglewood, Colorado called iBake. The way it works is when you walk in, the front of it is all glass containers containing bongs, rigs, t-shirts, stickers, hats, all different types of swag for sale. You fill out a membership agreement, which includes many different clauses, things from if we catch you taking someone's marijuana, we'll ask you to leave, to if we catch you selling marijuana, we will publicly humiliate you and ask you to leave. And that's actually something you have to sign your name to or they won't allow you membership. They charge $4.20 a day, $10 a month. If you pay the monthly fee because you're a local, I think they reduce it to $2.20 a day. This ruling would allow each business to decide what that model is. So if it's a higher end club and it's at the penthouse of a building in downtown Denver and they want to charge $100 a day, good for them. If someone wants to create a nonprofit downtown for the homeless to get them off the 16th Street Mall, where it's a very highly populated tourist area, if we want to get them out of that area, someone could create a nonprofit and charge a penny a day and get them off the street. We have in our language, it gives the arcades, movie theaters, bookstores, art galleries. These are all ideas that of businesses that have approached us that would be able to then purchase this license, which the licensing fees, I didn't even put up there. We are charging $150 for this license. Every marijuana license in Colorado begins at $5,000. So that really creates a very specific market niche in a lot of different areas. And so we had a lot of different stakeholders. And those stakeholders, that was one of their main concerns. How fair is it that people don't have $5,000 to start one of these clubs? What if it's a bookstore that's struggling to sell books, but if now they can sell tea and marijuana, but they can consume marijuana there, they might sell more books. It might change their revenue. Chances are it probably would. I would go to that bookstore. It would be the coolest Barnes & Noble ever. And the same with adult arcades. I mean, in Denver, they already exist with alcohol. You still see, you know, people getting frustrated with the games. People don't get that way when they smoke marijuana. Everyone just chills, and it's the next person's turn. So it's going to open a lot of types of business models. And I think that's one of my favorite parts about our language is it's going to bring out true entrepreneurship in people and people that can truly think outside the box. One of the biggest problems with our language in the beginning was so many people were concerned with that we did not include food. And we did not include, I said what you can have is prepared food and beverages only. We did not include restaurants, bars, or nightclubs. Those are the three business entities that are excluded from our licensure for a couple of reasons. There was an initiative attempt done last year by a different group, and their initiative was to allow consumption at bars and at restaurants. They did not provide a regulatory framework to support how that would happen. Instead, they just said, if you own a business and you have a patio and you want people to be able to smoke pot on it, that's cool. The city said, whoa, what, wait, how, first of all, are you going to allow people to do that? What business owners? Are then all restaurants in the city of Denver 21 and up so kids can't eat at them? None of these things were thought out. It was about to hit the ballot, and the day before it would have gone on the ballot, they pulled their initiative. Thankfully, though, because it has now allowed us to create what we have created, the pushback that they received was from a few different industries, the alcohol industry, the insurance industry, and the food and beverage. Alcohol, same. They did not want it. They flat out said, if you mix food and alcohol, or excuse me, alcohol and marijuana, we're going to pull your alcohol license. And we're at a point now where all of the nightclubs that currently exist, where people have been smoking pot for years, have now, the Denver PD has gone through and threatened all of these businesses' liquor licenses. So we just got rid of liquor. We have plenty of places to drink. We have plenty of places to eat. We don't have anywhere to consume marijuana. So why do we have to mix them together right now? Incremental politics, like Alan mentioned, baby steps. What we need to provide is a place to smoke. And so that's what we're consume. Let me get that right. We have one of our, someone at our last meeting said, what about edibles? What about this? So consume. We also included a, bring your own cannabis model. So Colorado Springs currently has, I believe, 14 clubs that are still in existence, but they have been given an 8-year phase out by their city council. They were given time to gather signatures for an initiative. They did not meet their deadline. So they have 8 years to all close their business. They will probably try again next legislative session to come out with another initiative, but as of now, that's where they're all kind of stuck. And so we tried to learn from what they've done right and what they've done wrong. They have trade model. So if people come in, you can say, oh, I bought this pipe, but it happened to come with $25 worth of weed. So we don't allow that. There's no on-site sale, distribution, trade. It's bring your own cannabis. Again, our problem is we don't have anywhere to smoke, but you can buy it at 200 places. So let's have a place to go. Yes, makes sense. And so we also have included a special event permit. Oh, same zoning. We have very specific zoning in the state of Colorado and in the city of Denver for both retail marijuana businesses as medical marijuana businesses, both grows, dispensaries, and MIPS, infused product establishments. And so what we did was not try to reinvent the wheel. These laws already existed. So primarily our legal counsel, Judd Golden, who's on the board of Colorado Normal, he's an incredible attorney. I wish he was here. Thank you, Judd. He crafted this 10-page ordinance draft for us. And we just literally copy and pasted that exact same coding to work with the city. Again, we were trying to have the least amount of pushback from the least amount of industries possible. And so far, we've been very successful at that. By now, the previous initiative attempt, I believe, had already heard from the Department of Justice. Fingers crossed, we are doing okay. We have been very transparent with the mayor's office, with the entire city council. When we first started this language, I wrote to each city council representative, all 13 of them, said the summary, said this is what we're doing. If you have any questions, I'm an open book. Not one reached out. The mayor's office eventually did. We've had roundtable discussions with them. We've been very transparent with them. This is an ongoing issue, and it's not going to go anywhere. So they've said publicly that they were going to talk about it, but then no discussions took place. So we bypassed all that, and we're taking it to the citizens. That's what our ballot initiative is all about. If they've voted for Amendment 64, chances are they're going to vote in favor of now giving that place for people to consume. So special events as well, 21 and up only, invitation only, so that it would be a private event. No on-site sale or distribution, same model, bring your own cannabis. Currently, the city of Denver allows 15 special events per year for any alcohol type event. We knew that people already feel that that wasn't enough. We had numerous stakeholder conversations. Long story short, we ended on 24 calendar events per year, per entity, business, or venue. So if you want to have 24 and you want to have 24 and you want to have 24, you could apply. And the city said to us, what are we going to do if on January 1st, 400 people show up here and want permits? And I was like, I don't know. You guys are going to make a lot of money, I guess. I mean, is that a problem? You guys have just made $1 billion. So I think it keeps us at that top spot in policy, which is what we're trying to put Normal on the map for continuing to do for this country. No liquor or food licenses for example, again, a nightclub. In the beginning, we were thinking there could be a caveat to the law that if we shut down their liquor license for 24 hours, they could then apply for this permit. Liquor board's not having that. If there's liquor there, there's not marijuana. And again, all that does is give us the ability to prove that we're responsible users. We had an event recently in Denver called the Indo Expo. There were 5,000 attendees over a 2-day span, zero incidents, of course. Down the street, there was a gun show and a motorcycle rally, and it was at the same hotel. There were 3 stabbings and 2 shootings, and we were a mile away from each other. Where do you think the headlines were? You know, of course, with all the alcohol. And here we are being completely quiet, good patrons and citizens, and you know, it's amazing to me. So this would allow any of those businesses to then apply for a permit so that we could lawfully consume our legally purchased cannabis products. So that is our primary number one issue in Denver, is responsible use Denver. So if you would like to support us, if you would like more information, responsibleusedenver.com. And I'll be here, of course. What else are our problems? Well, advertising. Cannabis advertising. High Times, I'm sure we all recognize. Quite a few of these publications started in Colorado and have now received national publication. Some of them are sticking in Colorado. Sensi is brand new. So there is no lack of marijuana publications, to say the least. The majority of these, I believe, are free, actually, in Colorado. You can find them at any head shop, dispensary, really anywhere in Denver. The back of every one of these magazines, with the exception of a couple that are truly more just editorial, is coupons. Pages and pages and pages of coupons for joints and money off of eighths. And it's unbelievable. When I first moved to Colorado 6 years ago, I was like, wait, this is a coupon for weed. I can take this into a store and I can use the... It blew my mind. It still does. So with that being said, there is no lack of it, but we do have some very interesting laws. The way that it works in Colorado is 70% of your audience has to be over the age of 21. How are they proving that? I haven't figured that out, but that's the law. We had a huge rally the day before we left. It was supposed to be the 420 rally. It was canceled, so they had it on 521. It was interesting because as we were walking through, we had numerous volunteers with us for the responsible use petition to gather signatures. And as we were walking through the crowds, we couldn't find any of the vendors that we were looking for because all of the tents were white. And I've been to numerous events in the city of Denver, and I've never seen this before, and I can't understand why we can't find anyone. Finally, we learned that they banned advertising from anyone that had a license, whether it was to cultivate, to have a MIP, to be a dispensary, whatever it was. You had to have a white tent, you had to remove all branding, all logos, and if you were handing out swag for the weekend, it had to be given out in black plastic bags. So it was more waste. Probably can't recycle the bags because you can't recycle our bottles that they make us use either. It was insane to witness. And it was so perfectly timed that I was coming here to talk about our advertising issues still, because I was in such shock that we're you know, going into 4 years of being, you know, legal, not medical. And this is still an issue. They had to build these boxes that they put TV screens in, because the only way you can look at the pictures of the strains is if they face the sky. So they built these special boxes, and I didn't have time to get you a slide, I took pictures of them, that housed these huge flat screen TVs so that people could walk up to the booth and be like, hey, what's going on over here? Because there was nothing to look at. They had no product out, they had nothing you could see, and it was a 420 rally. We were the only people there discussing anything that had to do with marijuana legislation or marijuana in general, but there were plenty of alcohol vendors there. So just very interesting how we're still fighting that fight. Websites, I'm sure you guys have all seen, if you go to numerous dispensaries' websites, it's a one click, do you verify you're 21? I think any 16-year-old can also click that button that says, are you verifying you're 21? So we still have a ways to go with advertising laws for sure. Banking, or lack thereof, I should say. It's all about verbiage when you go into these places, so I've learned. When I went to open our bank account for our initiative, I was denied by 5 in one day. And at the 5th one, I had really started to learn what not to say to get as far as I possibly could with what I needed. And so I got all the way to having this woman have a conference call with her national office, and we were on speakerphone together. And I had just been saying at that point it was for social clubs. I didn't say they were marijuana social clubs. I was just saying social clubs. And three questions in, they had already started filling out paperwork too, by the way. It was the farthest I had gotten. And the gentleman on the phone actually said, "Wait a second, is this for marijuana?" And I just sat there, probably white as a ghost, and said, "Yes." And the woman clicked the speakerphone off, stood up and put her hands on her hips and said, "You should have told me. You should have told me you were here for marijuana. Marijuana is illegal. You need to leave." And threw me out of the bank. And I was like, "Ma'am, I'm not here to discuss law with you. I'm here to discuss opening a bank account for a political campaign. I'm not here to have a marijuana business." And she said, "I don't care if marijuana is legal in Colorado. It is federally illegal, and you get out of this bank." And so I did. And then I just did some research, found out who the last initiative attempt used, and then used their bank. Also, again, very careful with the wording, but it worked. So far, so good. It's a political campaign, so they allowed us to open an actual political action committee. So we still have a lot of work to do. We had one bank actually try to open. It was called the Fourth Corner Credit Union. I believe they were open. I think they got like 12 clients. And then when they finally sent their paperwork in for federal approval for the very first marijuana credit union, they were, of course, denied. So then they were shut down and the money was given back. And that was the end of Colorado marijuana banking. So it's a federal issue. It's going to continue to be a federal issue. And it's something we still have a lot to work on. Drug testing. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Coats versus Dish, the Dish Network. So a gentleman by the name of Brandon Coats, he is a quadriplegic in the state of Colorado. He has been a medical marijuana patient for a number of years. He worked for Dish for a number of years. They did a random drug test. He failed. He is a medical marijuana patient. He attempted to use his rights as a medical marijuana patient to trump his job's decision. They took it to federal court. He was denied and fired because it, again, goes back to the company at large has federal funding. And they did not want their employees to be using marijuana. So it was just that simple. This is something I hear about all the time, people getting tested, people getting fired. It's a shame, and it's something we still have a lot of work to do on as well. But it's definitely one of our big concerns in Colorado, and it's something we face every day. Home cultivation. I just picked four of the more common places you guys have probably heard of. In Boulder, six plants is new for them. That's some big changes that just happened for them. They used to have a law called the Land Use Code that allowed any homeowner or rural space owner to grow in 300 square feet of space. Well, they finally figured out that you can sometimes put 50 to 100 plants in 300 square foot of space. And they said, "Wait a minute, you guys can't do that. That's way more than anyone else in the entire state of Colorado." So they stopped that, I believe, last week. And so now it is down to six plants, period. In Denver and Colorado Springs, we have the same law, 12 plants, six in flower, six in veg. I don't know how many people here grow in your homes. I don't know. It's not legal, I know, in most places. That's a picture from our home grow, actually. That's some of our Mandarin cookies. I thought that'd be appropriate. But we used to be able, in both Colorado Springs and Denver, to grow whatever our plant count was. So we have now changed it to just 12 and 6 because some patients were given 99 plants. And again, that's a lot of plants for one person's house, considering electrical systems weren't built to sustain that in your standard home. In Pueblo, they have 12 to 36 plants depending on how large their living structure is. So it's a little bit different. It's all about square footage and where they're at. Back to Colorado Springs in Denver, they have also banned home extractions using butane. So now the only extraction process you can do is either with dry sift or the new rosin technique. I don't know how many of you have heard about that, but that's still okay, and ice water extractions are still okay. But everything else, Not okay anymore. Yes, alcohol is okay. Ethanol is fine. That was a big fight. Kevin at the back of the room had a big part in that actually still being part of our law. Sorry, I know we have many people, so I'll move quickly. Alan mentioned, is there a law in Colorado? Yes, there is a law. 5 nanograms. How much sense does that make, and where did they get that research? That's something we're trying to argue. So currently the Department of Transportation and the MED are independently researching the 5-nanogram law that they have created to verify if that should in fact be the correct amount. I personally would test positive for 5 nanograms at any given time of my day ever, because I am on either hash capsules or edibles or something. I've had 6 major surgeries. I have constant nausea and pain every day of my life. Marijuana makes me live. So again, how much sense does that make? We're not really sure.
One thing in Virginia, it's 50 nanograms or less, and it's not even a positive. It's not positive for marijuana.
Wow. And also in the state of Colorado, if you are asked to be tested on site and you refuse, your license is revoked. As Ellen mentioned, we are one of those 22. Moving on. Oh, what about the children? Everyone thought Colorado was going to explode and all the kids were going to overdose and die. It hasn't happened because we know why. What is House Bill 161373? Basically, it just passed and it's pretty incredible. It would allow students to use medical marijuana at school, on the bus, at a school activity, or on school grounds. If each individual school district in the state of Colorado has to come out with a policy for each school. And if they lose federal funding for any reason, the state will return that funding to them. So it's a pretty amazing policy. The other one we just passed, no product shaped like humans, animals, fruit, or anything enticing to children. We have Sour Patch Kids, gummy bears, Swedish fish, lemon drops, cherry tarts. We have all these things. No more. They also, as of October of this year, they're removing the word candy from everything. Candy or candies. So including the marijuana strains, cotton candy, candy kush, green candy, they all have to be changed. So it's pretty interesting. This is regarding our out-of-state investors. So currently, their law says 2 years residency. This is the bill that they just created that would give... Sorry, I have to hurry up here. There's 2 more people. So just go ahead and read that. It basically allows back interest to come in. It's very sneaky, is what they did. They're now allowing new investors to come in a very, very lawful way, but very sneaky way. Medical marijuana product testing, we have just mandated that you have to test all medical marijuana now in addition to recreational marijuana. Why they didn't start testing medical marijuana from the beginning, none of us know, but now you have to, thank goodness. We're seeing lots of issues with pesticides. That's been our big thing. We did a huge recall in March, and all the plants had to be shredded with like this massive wood chipper. They deemed the plants improper for human safety. So they brought these massive wood chippers to all these dispensaries and made a public spectacle in front of the companies, took out plants one by one and put them through these shredders. The thing is with pesticides, the majority of the pesticides that were being used in grows are for things and other agricultural means. Tomatoes, potatoes, corn. But the thing is, we don't smoke corn, and we don't put tomatoes through a glass tube and blast them into hash. So we don't know what happens to our lungs and to our bodies when we eat those pesticides, when we smoke those pesticides, or we rub them on our bodies in the form of topicals. So that's why we have cracked down big time on the use of pesticides, and we're going to continue to do so. I will pretty much leave you guys with that. When it legalizes near you, know that there's still lots of issues. People asked, why did we start Denver Normal when marijuana has been legal there for years now? This is why. All the things that I just said to you. Thank you.
No, Thank you, Jordan. And that is exactly right, that once it's legalized for the consumer advocacy groups that really care about this, the work isn't over. It's changing. Many of us won't be involved in that work anymore. But so Jordan's a great example of what's happening in Denver. I'm going to ask Kevin to come up and talk about his unique experience as somebody who is licensed to cultivate some beautiful marijuana in Washington.
I've got some. So my wife put this PowerPoint together. She uses it in some of the work she does, so it's going to be pretty pictures. So my name is Kevin Oliver. I'm from Washington State. I'm the executive director of the Washington affiliate. And as Alan said, I'm also on the executive board of directors of the national organization, which is a pretty cool place to be in this time and space. What do you do after legalization? It's kind of, we're in the forest and can't hardly see the trees in states like Colorado and Washington. And we find that there's a big disconnect between when we used to booth and talk and collect initiative signatures and try to raise funds and what's happening now when things go legal. And it's kind of where the rubber hits the road is regulation. And the gentleman from the Brookings Institute highlighted that eloquently. Once the statutes are changed, once the laws are reformed, once the Constitution has been amended, then the regulations occur. And as he mentioned, it's in every other consumer agency. I have to agree with everything that Jordan just said, you know, the DUID, the pesticide testing, the home use lounges. We've legislatively tried to fix all of that. Some of it has been through rulemaking. The personal use lounges was shot down without a hearing in legislature last year. We'll try it again this year. Same with home grow. But instead of rehashing those points or going over piece by piece, I'd like to talk about the regulation as an industry stakeholder and an advocate. I got into planting, 500 marijuana plants because I was an activist first, and I thought it was a great evolution since I could. And just to illustrate, my wife and I are kind of grinning, and there's a gray cloud behind us, and that's really a symbolism. Is the next storm going to blow our plants over? Is the next regulatory guidance going to put us out of business? And so it's not all blue sky and big smiles. And I'm supposed to just push a button here? That's all right.
That works. Since you're off, did you?
I don't know what I did.
We're standing.
The next storm.
Chris.
Anyway, so.
There you go. Okay. And then you're going to push right here.
Right here. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. I pushed the wrong button. I do that a lot.
That was the wrong button. There it is.
It's the pot. Okay. So 78% THC. What you see here is our zoning issue. The map's pretty self-explanatory. In red counties, these are all the counties of the state. And what you don't see are the cities, but that is the barcode to the right, city zoning. You don't really see that on here. But those counties are red, no pot, nothing. They might as well be prohibition. The greener counties, permanent zoning, where Spokane County, King County, most of it is green. That means the county commissioners, the city councils have gone through the regulatory steps, to make sure that these are the rules and zones for marijuana. It's in limbo in most of the state and still zoned out in part of it. The initiative author, Allison Holcomb of the ACLU, who now runs up their national campaign to end mass incarceration, is convinced that since she did not put a line in the initiative that suggests that there's an opt-out option, which Colorado does have an opt-out option, that when the cases in these red zones or in the yellow zones finally get to the Supreme Court of Washington, that 502 as a state law will in fact trump these local bans and moratoriums. Now, the Attorney General of the state has a different opinion, but his opinion is not binding. It's going to be based on the decision of the courts, but it's going to take it another year before it gets there, and it's already been in the courts for a year, and there's someone who wants to buy some pot. Legally, actually. It's a store in Washington. Dang it. And I had a whole, everything was on my phone here. A timer, so I could see what I was doing. All right, so the next, so what we've got now, and all this zoning was done through regulatory actions. This ban language, I want to just, some of these bans, this is the rationale that has convinced these folks that they shouldn't have legal marijuana in their state, and they're going to go ahead and support the black market. You know, this action is to not overburden any single community with a disproportionate impact from retail businesses, which may attract illegal and or nefarious ancillary activities. Really, you know, selling legal marijuana, you're going to have heroin addicts dropping their needles on the sidewalk. I mean, churches are still saying that today. And, the, you know, this action is only the only effective means to ban the marijuana, is the only way to keep it away from the children because, you know, drug dealers ID, right? They're liable for a felony when they send in sting operations to buy. No, you know, I'm being sarcastic. I'm sorry. But, you know, so this is some of the language that is supporting the regulatory framework. Now, this is not a joke. This is from the Governor's Office for Regulatory Innovation and Assistance for all rulemaking, expedited rulemaking, emergency rulemaking, whether it's a municipality or it is done through the Liquor Control Board, which oversees all of our marijuana rules in Washington State. This is what we deal with. Now, in order for regular business owners and stakeholders to be involved in this, they practically have to hire a full-time lobbyist or attorney to take care of it. So to get to, you know, how does the rubber hit the road as far as an advocacy group, especially a consumer advocacy group, where you want to provide as many people as possible that want it, 21 and over, responsible, safe, low-priced, high-quality marijuana, in order for these regulations to better affect the industry so the consumer can be rewarded, one of the things that we've gone ahead and decided to do is start a state PAC, which, like the normal PAC, will fund legislators and processes that will empower smoking lounges, home grows, things like that, and keep an eye on this regulatory framework, nightmare, web, whatever, matrix, for the industry as a whole, from a consumer point of view. And we'll hire a real lobbyist, a former senator who was actually on the original Liquor Control Board, has expressed interest, and we'll be hopefully securing that in July. He's already a lobbyist for Live Nation and Group Health, so he's a good guy to have on our side. I'm certainly not the best one to try to convince the governor to change the laws, personally. So with this regulatory framework, we've got... These are just a few examples that are presently in process, that are currently in process, that are going to affect and advise national rollout. We have liaisons from Governor's Office of the Washington State, as well as EPA and other groups that are federally interested, to look at what we're doing in Washington as far as regulating state building codes. They wanted to put an F1 rating on hoop houses and greenhouses. Now, if you know what a hoop house is, it's just a PVC pipe stuck in the ground with some visqueen over the top. F1 ratings are hurricane ready, fire suppression systems, you know, firewalls, hard floors, and, you know, hoop houses are in almost every agricultural zone in the state. The Clean Air Agency, by the way, my wife sits on both of these regulatory advisory groups. The Clean Air Agency is going to ultimately end up billing all of us. They're about two or three meetings out from finalizing it. Growers, at least $2,400 a year as a fee, because, you know, the smell of marijuana might give your neighbor 10 miles down the road asthma or something. What's interesting is that we're finding that marijuana is the exception. It is treated so much different than any other type of agriculture, any other type of consumer product. And one of the things that we've found time and time again when it comes to these other regulatory agencies that are coming in after the fact, new to the game, many who don't even want to be involved in the process, some who might have their own predisposed stereotypes and prejudices about pot, and others who are on our side and probably smoke it. But what these regulatory agencies are doing is they're quoting this red text. The term agriculture, farming, horticulture, anything to do with plants, may not be construed to include or relate in any way to marijuana, marijuana-infused products, marijuana production. Anything applicable to marijuana is not going to be considered agriculture. But note that this is a Department of Revenue excise tax, RCW. This was amended so that we, as growers of acres of pot, I only took down a couple tons, but that was wet weight. I'm sorry. We're not allowed to take the same deductions as anyone who even has a Christmas tree farm, or they grow organic spinach, or they grow thousands of acres of wheat. So this Department of Revenue, RCW, has been blindly adopted, taken out of context, this third paragraph, and applied to these other regulatory agencies, and they're coming in first day and saying, okay, clean air, we can't have pot, it's not pot, it says right here, it's not pot. The building code, well, we can't treat it like, you know, farmers who have grown hoop houses because it's not pot, it says so right here in this law. And so we're there in these meetings as advocates to suggest that that only applies to the Department of Revenue. That does not supersede all the other laws and all the other regulatory agencies in the state. But time and time again, it gets back to this last slide, you know, marijuana is the exception. And it's taken a great deal of education to talk to educated people and folks who've been doing, you know, working through the maze of regulatory actions time and time again to explain to them that, you know, it really is farming. And it brings up an interesting point about the industrialization of marijuana. You know, ultimately, you know, you have farming connects you to the earth and an industry kind of takes you away from it. Let's just say for the sake of argument, big business doesn't really care about the consumer. They just want to sell candies that look like pot. They don't care if the kids buy it. They want to infuse their stuff with, you know, flavors so it's not just terpenes. And maybe, you know, they don't care what kind of pesticides they use. And they'll easily put as much, a few million dollars into an infrastructure and use as much energy as a small town without any regard to the environment or consumers. Now, let's just say that's the case, and let's say that there's also these government agencies who are coming in blindly, not treating marijuana like a plant, not treating it naturally, not thinking of the consumers either. Mm-hmm. And the question then, as marijuana rolls out around the country, as someone who's personally involved in the industry, is will there be outdoor pot? Should there be outdoor pot? And this is, I have to call it a farm. But these are some of the pictures of, without giving away my full controlled access, and you can't take these pictures and you know, break into easy. But here's the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. We took that last year. And then you know, some other shots, mainly one strain I cloned myself and planted in the ground with my wife. But these regulations are largely doing away with what we've come to know as marijuana, whether it's a home grow, which Washington hasn't allowed yet, or, you know, growing outdoors where plants typically grow. There seems to be this push against treating marijuana like marijuana, and it seems to be treated as a severe exception. And so while we have legalization, we have marijuana, we have a lot of pressures where the rubber hits the road in terms of regulatory compliance and new issuances, and these are coming down every week, every month, that are keeping this industry not in check, but on its toes and on guard. And that is, to other states that are going to roll out, I mean, that's the cautionary tale right now, is how marijuana rolls out. And will it be able to roll out with any freedom? My guess is the last few states to roll out won't have any production at all. They'll just be buying their pot from other states, just like we do bread and beer now. That's my spiel, and I hope for the sake of consumers we still have outdoor pot. But
Yeah, it would seem kind of ironic to make marijuana legal, but making it, growing it outdoors under the sun in soil illegal. Maybe it's just me. So, other than Keith, the person who has worked the longest and continuously to reform marijuana laws in one form or another, is Kevin Zeese. He's got at least 30 to 35 years into this space. And so in some ways, Kevin, it's sort of almost beware what we ask for, right? And we know what's coming, so please, let's hear the view of a real visionary about the end of Prohibition and what does post-Prohibition look like that is fair and equitable in this country.
Wow, 35 years. Well, it's great to be here. I think the question of the year is, in how many states will marijuana beat the presidential candidates? And I think it's going to be a lot of them. And that's just going to make marijuana when I got into this, really a third rail issue that any politician who touched it, you know, got burned. It's going to become a politically powerful issue that is going to be much harder for anyone to stop. And so I think we're in a really great moment. I'm so glad to see it happening. And so congratulations to everybody here. And I know there's so many others who've been working on this. It's a real group effort and a long time one. So we should all congratulate ourselves for making that kind of progress. So thank you all. I'm always less than Keith. I guess you're at 45 years or so or something like that. This is really a great moment, and I think I want to thank you all first for coming to Washington, D.C. to lobby Congress. I've lived in the D.C. area since 1977 when I came here for law school, and I live in Baltimore now, and I come to D.C. a lot for work. When I go to Congress, though, I'm usually risking arrest. It's usually disrupting a meeting or holding a sign or blockading a door because, you know, you're going into a den of thieves up there. I mean, this is a pretty much a criminal enterprise that we're living in where they're taking money for their buddies on Wall Street and the big banks are making out like bandits and the rest of us are all suffering. So thank you very much for going up there and facing that. It's not an easy place to work. And the good news that you're in is that we actually have momentum. I just saw last week that Congress passed a law that allows veterans to be able to get marijuana medically for PTSD. That's amazing to see that kind of thing happening. It's a great step, and especially for this kind of Congress. So post-Prohibition, as our previous speakers have said, so I'm not going to have to repeat it all, is not the end. Dealing with the legal issues around the criminality of marijuana leaves us a big knot to untie with lots of strands in it. And they affect really every aspect of life, as we've heard, education, housing, you know, child welfare, employment, so many issues. It's a really complicated knot to untie. It's going to take a lot of patience for us to overcome it. And this happened because what became obvious even by the time I was in this, which would, you know, was a difficult time for marijuana reform, when President Reagan was coming into office and saying "just say no" with his wife Nancy cheering that on, and we saw pretty much a bipartisan Congress passing extreme laws, the Incomprehensible Crime Control Act of 1984 that brought us mandatory sentences and forfeiture of property, and then 2 years later they passed more mandatory sentences. You know, we saw them using chemical warfare to try to stop marijuana from going. We saw the drug testing starting to take root in the early 1980s. It started, by the way, with prisoners who had no rights, then went to the military who had few rights, and then out into the general population. Now it's a very challenging force for us to deal with. But the reason all these things happened was because even at that point, it was obvious that marijuana prohibition could not be enforced. They could not win with law enforcement. They were arresting hundreds of thousands, about 400,000 people a year back in the early 80s. That kept increasing, but it didn't stop the marijuana from continuing. And so they had to find new tools. They had to find new ways to try to defeat those of us who wanted to consume. And there were tens of millions. And so in a culture like ours, and with a plant like marijuana that could, you know, grow in a closet and be worth more than gold by the ounce, it was not possible for law enforcement to win. And so they took these other approaches, and that leaves us with a big knot to untie. Drug testing, I think, is one that has lots of different strands of its own. In the employment sphere, we have very difficult challenge because the United States is basically a country that the employees have no rights in, that it's an employer at-will country. Unless you have a contract that you've negotiated as a collective bargaining agreement and changed and added some rights, the basic rule is employee at will, which means the employer can hire you or fire you for any reason or no reason. And so with that reality, it becomes very difficult for us to go with drug test. Say you can't drug test for marijuana and you can't fire someone for marijuana. Now, we can do a lot, and this will affect not just employment but other aspects of drug testing. We can do a lot about the reality of what drug tests show. It's amazing how people are still confused about that. You know, marijuana positive urine test doesn't really show that you used at work, doesn't show you're impaired or intoxicated, and yet people still believe that, even though that's pretty much out there. And so I think there's still a lot of work to do on education on that front. And I think when we see legal marijuana, we can also be pushing in the courts, probation departments. We can be pushing in child services. We can all the various ways that drug testing is used in the justice system or the court system. Again, education. What does a positive actually mean? Does it mean that someone has a problem with marijuana use? Are they some kind of abuser, whatever that is, of marijuana? It doesn't show that. And so I think a lot of our work when it comes to drug testing is going to be around education. One thing I want to caution people about with the victories that we're having is watch out for the backlash. On these social justice issues, all of them, there are people who are, you know, on both sides and who feel strongly about their position. And, you know, we can still see the abortion backlash from, you know, the 1970s when abortion was made illegal. There's still a fight going on. And, you know, basically what happened when I came into Normal was we were in the midst of a backlash from the success of the 70s. You know, 11 states covering one-third of the population had decriminalized marijuana. Two dozen other states had passed laws allowing for conditional discharge, which meant you got unsupervised probation for 6 months and then your record was erased. And so over 30 states had passed some kind of a decriminalization or pseudo-decriminalization. And at the same time, we started to see paraphernalia shops, head shops, starting to pop up. And the mistake there was the kind of overconfidence and having head shops with all sorts of interesting front windows, with all sorts of interesting devices being displayed. And, you know, parents saw that, walked by that with their kids, and there came a parents' movement that, you know, came back against us and really was a big setback. And it was, of course, timed with the conservative era of Reagan and Bush coming into office. And so beware of the backlash. I already see signs of backlash in some of our legal states. I saw an article last week about how some communities are complaining about the odor of marijuana cultivation sites in their neighborhoods, or are worried about, you know, and people talking about not getting along with neighbors. And so we need to be careful about that. These little angers about the legal marijuana laws could turn into, you know, a countercurrent can turn into an overcurrent. It can become a wave. And so we have to kind of be facing up to that and not go too far and not be too overconfident, not show too much hubris, but to listen to people who are against us and try to figure out ways to work with them and minimize their anger, because we don't want to see a counter-reactionist. We're going to have Hillary Clinton in office most likely soon, and she's not a legalizer. Now, maybe when we do better than she does in the votes on November, maybe she'll see she's on the wrong side of this political issue, but she also may have the opposite reaction and get angry about losing to marijuana. So we could see, you know, she's not, she's someone who could become part of a counter revolt to our success. And so pay attention to those small waves that are starting to show their signs, because they can really have devastating impact. I think we're so well rooted now in some states, that's going to be very hard to have a complete reversal. But as we know, there are lots of other issues, you know, that affect all aspects of life that could get even harder on, you know, and make those situations worse for marijuana consumers, and that will, of course, be setbacks that we don't want to see happen. As Alan said, I work on lots of issues now, and my major project is called Popular Resistance, which came out of the Occupy movement, and it deals with about 15 issues. Marijuana and drug policy are still one of the top 15, maybe in the top 10 even. One of the things I'm doing is I'm working with someone who's running for mayor in Baltimore, where I live, and he is. We're developing a kind of model urban economic agenda for the 21st century. How do these so many urban areas have been, ignored, underfunded, and really gone downhill over the last generation? And how do we correct that? How do we get on track? And Baltimore is, of course, one of the prime examples. We have something like 44,000 abandoned properties. We have high crime rates. We have a terrible education system. There's, lots of vacant space in office buildings. It's, lots of problems. Policing. We just had a not guilty verdict today in one of the Freddie Gray Gray cases. So we'll see what happens with that this evening. And so there's lots of challenges. And so Joshua Harris, who I'm working with, is running for mayor, and he's putting forward a model urban policy that deals with lots of issues. Marijuana is a very small part of it, but lots of issues. But marijuana is part of it. And one thing that we're doing on the economic side, obviously on the criminal justice side, we have things that we're doing on marijuana policy and drug policy as well. But on the economic side, what we want to start to do is look at how does a city prepare for the coming legal market of marijuana. And what that means is how do we make it fit in with the community values? How do we make sure it benefits people who live in Baltimore? Personal cultivation issues, a lot of the issues that we're talking about here, come up in that discussion. And it's a very different position to be in when you're compared to being an advocate for legal marijuana and ultimate, as much freedom as possible for marijuana consumers. Then when you're looking at it from a perspective of trying to make this something that people of Baltimore want and will accept. And it's coming. We have a medical dispensary. We don't have a medical dispensary yet, but we're going to get our first medical dispensaries probably next year, maybe the end of next year. And so we'll start to have that happening. And there's talk about illegal marijuana legislation in the Annapolis legislature. Hasn't passed yet, but it's starting to, get some energy behind it. And so it's starting to come. And so how does the city prepare? And I'd love if anyone has ideas on that, by the way. Feel free to write me. You can write, if you go to popularresistance.org, you can just write info@popularresistance, and you can write to me about it. I'd love to get people's thoughts on how cities should prepare for that in ways that make marijuana something acceptable. We think it's going to be something that is going to excite a lot of people in Baltimore, the idea that we're even talking about it, and that we're planning for it and preparing for it and see it as a potential economic opportunity for the city. And so we see big positives in it, but we also see risks. Mayor Schmoke, who really helped to move this issue forward when he was mayor of Baltimore, was very good at finding ways to talk to conservative black churches in Baltimore, who really are the women who go to church in Baltimore are the dominant political force. Other than the big developers who pay for the elections, the black women in church, they are the dominant political force. And so how do we make that something that they accept? And he did one thing. He asked three questions. And I think it's always good to try to frame things in ways that, you bring people to your conclusion. His first question was, do you think that the war on drugs, the war on marijuana is working? And the obvious answer is no. Will more of the same work? Obvious answer is no. Are you willing to consider some alternative that might work? And that kind of pushes them into the direction of accepting that reality. And so we need to find ways to make this something that excites the community, that they see opportunity for people. We want to make sure people who've been involved in the marijuana market, convicted for marijuana offenses, are able to participate in that community. We have kind of the opposite view of we don't want a lot of outsiders coming in. And so that's really, something that's key to us. And so it's a different perspective. So please, if you have thoughts on that, I'd love to hear them. Let me just finish with one thing. When I first came into Normal, I think it was on the first day, 1979, they first gave me a bunch of letters to read from people who were either incarcerated or who had family members who were incarcerated. And from that moment on, it became obvious what this was about. And it's what it's about from now until we unravel this knot of policy challenges. It's really just about justice. That's what it's about. People being treated fairly, their human rights respected, And that's what this movement's been about, really, from the beginning. And I hope that we can keep making the build on the progress we're making and keep going all the way to coming up with some really sensible policies across the board. It's just about justice. And thank you all for being part of it.
Thank you very much, Kevin. And Kevin's life and advocacy speaks to that. You don't have to be a one-note Johnny. You don't have to be defined by the one thing that you maybe become famous for, and that there are much bigger fish to fry in this world than marijuana law reform. And Kevin's been doing that in spades for years. And so thank you all for your participation. We're gonna blow right through the break, and Steve's gonna bring up the next panel. And I do want to get this photograph with the three directors because that's a photo I want on my wall next week. Thank you very much.